Lecture 5, Historical Linguistics and Studying Culture.
Words and worlds. The Indo-European world was full of words, and we can gain access to their past by looking at the words that survive in modern languages. In this lecture, I'd like to extend and develop some of the issues I've been raising in previous lectures about the ways in which we can use the techniques of comparative and historical philology to understand the social and imaginative world of the Indo-European peoples. But I'd also like to show, as I've tried to show in previous lectures, that the study of those Indo-European peoples and languages is fascinating not only for its own sake, but for the light it sheds on the words of English that descend from those earlier Indo-European languages. So in order to look closely at the Indo-Europeans, we need to understand their intellectual, their literary, and their social life. And in particular, I'd like to show how the relationship between the real and the imagined in Indo-European culture informs some of the literary tropes and metaphors, some of the great themes and genres of the Western tradition. Let's begin, if you like, at the top. Let's begin with the belief system of the Indo-European peoples. Scholars have reconstructed a belief system that has a pantheon to it. In other words, it is a collection of many gods. Let me just pause and say a little something about pantheon. We think of that as a word from Greek, but it is a word made up of Indo-European roots. Theos in Greek comes from the same root that Deus comes from, or the word Zeus comes from. Deu in Indo-European, that is the root that was reconstructed, is a root that comes from a word meaning light or shine. And it also gives, over time, the Latin word dies, day. So it is assumed that the godhead, if you like, or the chief deities, there's our word again, deities, of the Indo-European peoples were deities of sky, of sun, of light. Pantheon. Pantheon means all the gods. Pan means all. But it is also the Indo-European root for five. Look at your hand. I have five fingers. That's all the fingers on my hand. And so the root for five and the root for all is the same. A fascinating way in which the bodily condition of life generates a verbal condition of description. And so, the pantheon has at the top a deu pater, as we would say in reconstructed Indo-European. That is, a deus, a god, pater, pater, father. There is a paternalistic structure to the pantheon, and this God the Father shows up in several Indo-European languages, not the least of which is Latin. Deus Pater becomes, if you say it very quickly, over a period, if you like to imagine, of 1,000 years, Jupiter. And so Jupiter's name simply means God the Father. The great Calvert Watkins, who I mentioned in my earlier lecture, was a scholar of the Anatolian languages, the languages of Hittite, and the languages of Asia Minor, has found in Hittite a phrase, tatis, to us. Tatis is father, dada, pater, and to us, deus, another father god. What do you do with a god? You believe in a god. And if you believe in a god, you have a creed. Credo in unum Deum. In Latin Christendom, I believe in one God. The word credo, in Latin, the verb meaning I believe, comes from an Indo-European root, cred, do. And cred, or cred, is the root for heart, cardia. Do means to put, to donate, to give. So the word credo, or creed, in Latin, comes from an ancient Indo-European expression, which means to place in the heart. That is what belief is. You place in the heart, but you also place the believing body in the ground. You will remember from an earlier lecture that I noted how the Indo-European peoples were, as archaeologists have shown, inhumators rather than cremators. They buried their dead. And to bury is sepelio. Now, this is an old verb meaning to venerate the dead. And in Latin, it becomes the verb sepelire, which means to bury. And in English, we have borrowed this word from Latin to give us the word sepulcher, a place in which the dead are buried. Now, this set of examples can tell us something about the Indo-European peoples and also about how the surviving languages that descended from these Indo-European roots preserve an older set of beliefs, a paternalistic god, a way of believing, a belief that the heart is the locus of faith, and a social ritual of faith, that is, burial. The Indo-European languages are rich with theological terms, but they are also rich with legal terms. Terms for law have ancient roots. Our very words, law, legal, come from the same words that give us ligature, to link. A law is something that links or binds up a people. Who is the linker but the reg, the rex, the raj, the rix, the ruler? In my earlier lecture, I had mentioned how one of the earliest correspondences among the Indo-European languages that scholars such as William Jones had noticed were the words for rule. And what I'd like to add to that observation is the idea that these words are also words that survive in, if you like, the languages on the geographical periphery of Indo-European culture. That is, Rix is Celtic and Raj is Indic. Reich is German and Rex is Latin. It is as if the Indo-Europeans carried with them from their point of origins notions of rulership that survived at the borders, at the endpoints, at the very edges of the Indo-European migration. Now, I have been talking about some of these words, and I've been talking about law and culture, words like rule, words like law. Take a word like jus, justice, bond, and net. All of these are words that concern the binding together of a peoples. But what's also interesting is that what binds a people together are habits of exchange, gift-giving, and hosting. What is fascinating about the words for giving and taking is that the Indo-European roots very often descend into later languages to mean two opposite things. For example, the root do in Indo-European survives in Latin to the verb donare, meaning to give, and we use it today in our word donate. But in Hittite, the word do meant to take or to receive. The root nem in Indo-European was the word for giving, and nemesis in ancient Greek was the god who gave out or meted out justice. But the word survives in the Germanic languages to give us words such as modern German nehmen, meaning to take. So you have a single root which probably meant something like exchange or give and take. And in the surviving languages and in the later cultures, it sorted itself out as one or the other. Another good example of this are the words for host and guest. Now, Indo-European had a root that scholars have reconstructed, gosti. Now, you'll remember that, as in my previous lecture, I mentioned that Indo-European had a distinctive set of sounds, aspirated stops, gosti. We would write it with a GH now, gosti. This doesn't give us ghost in modern English, but it does give us two sets of words that do come into modern English, host and guest. Gosti must have meant something like the one who hosts and guests. That is, the same word used for the shared experience rather than for one person or another. It is a kind of social ritual word, and it gives us in Greek the word xenos, which means stranger. It gives us hostis, host, but it also gives us hostile. And so, host and guest, stranger and friend, we're looking here at a constellation of terms, concepts of otherness, of friends and potential enemies, a world of giving and taking, a world of hostsmanship. To be xenophobic is to have a fear of the foreign. Geographical and topographical reconstructions are what's at stake. We have not just belief, but we have the world. We have living in the world of experience and imagining the world of desire. And so, when we look in Indo-European, we're looking not only for words of things in the sky or social forms, but we're looking for everyday things. We're looking for plants. We're looking for animals. We're looking for the Indo-European economy. So many of the surviving Indo-European languages have a word that descends from grano, grain, rugo, rye, bahares, barley. And so we can assume that the original Indo-European peoples living in probably the shores along the shores of the Black Sea, as some have postulated, were cultivating grain. They domesticated animals. Gu is the root for cow. Su for swine. Agno is sheep. And that you can hear in agno, you can hear the Latin agnus, Agnus Dei, Lamb of God. Quon is hound or dog. Echo is horse. One of the fascinating things, as I've mentioned in my previous lectures, is not just what the Indo-European languages share, but what they don't share. And you'll remember how all the Indo-European languages did not have a shared word for the sea, but they did have shared words for rowing or navigating on a small body of water. One of the interesting things about the Indo-European languages is that while they all share a word for dog or hound, they do not share a word for cat. And so the assumption is that cats were domesticated later than dogs in Indo-European culture. Or a way of putting it might be to say that after the Indo-European peoples broke up into their constituent groups, after they migrated east and west, each new group learned how to domesticate the cat on their own, and that they named the domestic cat in their own descendant languages. I mentioned in a previous lecture the way in which we can do not just historical, but also cultural reconstruction, and that cultural reconstruction depends on sound. And I want to go back to an example that I'd given earlier in greater detail. I mentioned that so many of the languages in Indo-European have a word that descends from a kind of P word. In reconstructed Indo-European, it's piwo. And this becomes in Latin, pecunia, which means wealth. Sanskrit, it's pasu, livestock. Old English, theach, because you'll remember by Grimm's law that Germanic words with an F that are cognate with Indo-European words are cognate with words in Indo-European that had a P. So Old English, theach, cattle. Old Norse, fey, possessions. Modern German, fee, cow. Modern English, fee, meaning a payment for something. What we have here is evidence for a culture that considered livestock a form of wealth, and also a culture that, if you like, domesticated its livestock. The idea here is movable goods, or wealth in the form of domesticated animals. And it seems significant, too, that so many of the descendant Indo-European languages had a word not only for cattle, but a word for yoke. And so the assumption is that this culture, with its shared vocabulary, was a domestic agricultural economy. Now, let me digress and give you some more examples along these lines. And one way of doing it is to do it, if you like, topically or thematically. Another way of doing it is to do it, if you like, phonetically. I mentioned the P and F, and we saw how this is one of the most recognizable correspondences among the Indo-European languages. Let me give you a few more examples to pique your interest, but also to suggest the range of Indo-European culture and belief as it descends into the modern European cultures. Now, we have a word flow. We have a word fly. We have a word feather. There is, in the Germanic languages, a set of words that begin with F that all seem to suggest movement through a medium of some kind. These, if they have Indo-European cognate roots, should correspond to P words, and indeed they do. Flow, pluo. Now, if you ask yourself, what is the relationship between a word like English flow and an imagined root like pluo? What happens when it rains in France? Il pleut. That is, the idea of the rain, the verb for the rain, goes back to this Indo-European root, to flow or to move through a medium. And so the non-Germanic Indo-European word for rain seems to be cognate to the Germanic word for flowing. You fly, but we have feathers. All of these are going back to a word that in Indo-European is a root pet. And this pet word means also to move through the air. Pen is a word which in Latin does not mean a writing implement. A penna is a feather. And the F and the P look back to an old Indo-European root, which imagines for us movement through a medium. Let me give you one more example of this. My favorite, Pluto. What is Pluto the god of? Pluto is certainly the god of the underworld, but we use the word Pluto in a phrase like a plutocrat. Now, a plutocrat is not someone who rules from hell. A plutocrat is someone who gains power by virtue of his or her wealth. Plutonic, that is, the ancient name of Pluto, comes from the same word as the word flow. What happened when you dug metallic ore from the ground? You smelted it. And when you smelted it, it would melt, and the metal would flow out. And so, for Pluto was the god of the underworld, Pluto was also the god of the wealth buried in the underworld. And so flow and Pluto go together so that we can see historically the way in which the ancient name of the Greek god is, in fact, a word meaning to flow through a medium, and therefore it takes us back to ancient principles and techniques of smelting, of metallurgy, and of bullion wealth. When we think of wealth, we think of cattle, we think of gold, but we also think of the wealth of the imagination. And I'd like to conclude this lecture with an extended reflection on the Indo-European literary imagination. Scholars have reconstructed shared words for poet and for poetry and for certain literary concepts in the Indo-European languages. Let me give you some examples. There is a Latin word, vates, which means a seer or a prophet. And this is cognate with a whole set of other Indo-European words. Faith in Old Irish, meaning a bard. It's cognate with the word wode in Old English, which means crazy. Woden, or Odin. Woden is the chief god in the Scandinavian pantheon. Why is he Woden? He's Woden because he's not just crazy, but because he's a poet. Woden, or Odin, is the master of runes. He's the master of poetry. He gave an eye for wisdom. And so what Indo-Europeanists have seen in this collocation of words is an Indo-European root, wet, which goes back to this image of a crazed, seer, vatic figure, a poet and a madman. What do poets do? Poets weave words, and roots such as wek and tex are the old Indo-European roots for weaving. Now, in Latin, the verb texere, which comes from that root, meant to weave. And it could mean two things in Latin, just as it means two things in the languages that borrow that Latin word, like English. It can mean to weave with words, and that gives you a text. But it can also mean to weave with thread, and that gives you a textile. The poet was a weaver of words, much as the woman was a weaver of threads. And it is no accident that in the most ancient epics of the Western tradition, Homer's Odyssey, for example, you see Penelope weaving and unweaving, just as Homer himself weaves his words. This act of weaving shows up in Old English, where we are told the poets wordum rixlan, they weave words together. And yet, weaving was not the only thing that people did. They built with clay. They built with dirt. There is a wonderful Indo-European root, der, which means to build or to make something out of mud or clay. And to build around, para, deg, para, around, the root meaning around or about, means to encircle with a mud wall, para, deg. To encircle with a mud wall is to create, in the language of Iran, Farsi, Old Persian as well, paradais, a paradise. This word is borrowed by the Greeks, and it is borrowed by the other European languages to mean, in religious contexts, the place of the first beginning. But paradise simply means a walled space, an enclosed garden. The paradise, if you like, of Indo-European is the place of origin. And fame, heroic fame, was something that the Indo-Europeans and their descended peoples treasured, much as they would treasure gold or they would treasure cattle. Now, kleos is the Greek word for spoken fame. And in an earlier lecture, I mentioned how kleos is so much a part of the idiom of Greek epic. Kleos aphthiton is a phrase, undying fame. That's what the hero wants. What can we do with kleos? As I mentioned, Heracles. Heracles, the god or the hero Hercules, has a name which means nothing other than redounding to the praise of Hera. You can play this game with other names. How about Sophocles? Sophocles was a real person, but Sophocles is a meaningful name. Sophos Kleos. Fame or famous for wisdom. And so you can see how so many of the names of historical Greek figures, of Greek gods, of heroes, go back to these words that have their Indo-European roots. In the 19th century, scholars reading Greek knew of Kleos aphthiton, and they began to discover, as William Jones had discovered half a century before them, the texts of the Sanskrit religion, belief, and social structure, the Rig Veda, the Bhagavad Gita, the great texts of ancient subcontinental India. And in those texts, they found poems, and they found a phrase. And the phrase they found was Shravas Oxitam. Kleos Aphthiton, Shravas Oxitam. An Indo-Europeanist of great facility in the 19th century would have recognized that the K corresponds to the S, and that as they would work through each correspondence, remember Kentum and Satum, and they would realize that Kleos Aphthiton and Shravas Oxitam are cognate phrases. They meant the same things. They descended from the same root. The sound laws and correspondences between the Sanskrit and the Greek worked perfectly, and they scanned poetically the same way. That is, they were a metrical phrase. This is the idea of the formula. Indo-European poetry is formulaic, and we can see that in Homer, in such phrases as the wine-dark sea, cow-eyed Penelope, rosy-fingered dawn, or Odysseus of many wiles, polutropos Odysseus, many tropes, polutropos Odysseus. We see it in Old English poetry in its formulae. We even see it in the surviving oral epics of the Serbo-Croatian peoples. And so what was discovered here was not simply a word or phrase, but a poetic, an idea of a poetics. The study of Indo-European, as I've tried to suggest in this and in my previous lectures, is a revelation. And what I mean by that is that so much of our history of language has been veiled, that we need to get behind the words to see the origins. And if we think of revelation and we think of the veil, we must think too of Indo-European. The concept of the secret or of the prophetic is as central to Indo-European literary and religious thought as is the concept of the open and the famous. Now, there is a Greek word, kalypsein, and it means to hide. And this corresponds to a set of Germanic words and English words that begin with H. Kalypsein is actually cognate with hull, meaning a shell or a covering. Now, how could we take this observation and turn it into myth? Who is the goddess of Kalypsein? It is, of course, Calypso, the figure in the Odyssey who is the sorceress, the one who hides or conceals. What happens if you take away the covering? Apo in Greek is the prefix to take away. Apo kalypsein, to take away the covering. When Latin scholars translated the Greek for the Vulgate Bible, they simply translated it as removing the cover. Velum, veil, the cover, revelare, to reveal. Apocalypse and revelation mean the same thing. And what the study of Indo-European can reveal to us, I think, is precisely the way in which these ancient word roots give us some of our most modern, but also some of our most deeply held beliefs, social rituals, and imaginative structures.